for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, President Obama announced he would halt withdrawal of nearly 10,000 U.S. military personnel from Afghanistan. The announcement followed a series of meetings with top Afghan officials who had urged the White House to delay U.S. troop withdrawal. Joining me in the studio to discuss the president's announcement and what it could mean for Afghanistan as well as global security, Michelle Flournoy at the Center for a New American Security, David Rothkopf of the FP Group, and Lawrence Korb of the Center for American Progress. I do invite you, as always, to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And thank you all for being here.
Happy to be here, Diane.
Nice to be here.
Good to see you all. David Rothkopf, tell us about the agreement reached between the White House and Afghan officials.
I think this has been a kind of a good week for the White House, you know, after the acrimony that surrounds Netanyahu, or perhaps in the middle of the acrimony that surrounds Netanyahu, and after the bad relationship that they had with Hamid Karzai. They have in Ghani a leader in Afghanistan who is inclined to deal with them, who has a kind of outlook that dovetails with their outlook. He's brought with him his rival, who he's actually trying to work well with, Abdullah Abdullah, who's the chief executive in Afghanistan. They're presenting a united face. They're saying all the right things. It's clear they wanted to keep this troop level up because it plays to their stability concerns. And they'll get it through the end of the year. We'll see what happens next year. I think that the president is really committed to bringing the troop level down to a minimal level by the time he leaves office. But right now, you have a kind of unusual moment in Afghanistan where there is hope for this government, although it has not checked all the boxes in terms of getting itself organized. There is hope for the immediate future, but very, very big questions remain about whether stability can take real root and whether the unrest that has marked this country's history for the past 30 years will not regain the upper hand in the next couple of years.
It's interesting because this is not the first time the president's changed his mind on troop withdrawal and timing. Is there any chance that he might once again extend their stay?
Well, yes, there is a chance. I mean, our Afghan policy has seen a lot of ups and downs, and I think it was marked by a process that Michelle was part of early on where we talked about, are we going to have more troops, are we going to have less troops? And you captured the Afghan riddle by what I called the "Hello, I must be going" speech, where the president announced that he was ramping up troops and that we were going to get out at a date certain, because I think there was a kind of a deeply conflicted sense within the administration about what do you do here. But, for example, if you saw rapid deterioration in Afghanistan, either because of Taliban groups or because of new groups like ISIS, which are now trying to establish a foothold there, and you thought Afghanistan was trending towards Iraq and that kind of chaos, you might see the president deciding to leave more troops there or to do something to stabilize, because were he to leave office with Iraq and Afghanistan in chaos a la Iraq, that would be a real black eye.
Michelle, were you pleased with the president's decision, or were you hoping for a longer announcement?
You know, I was very happy to hear this decision. I think it's very smart. In some ways, it was a difficult decision for President Obama. But what this does is it gives us more time to help bolster the capabilities of the Afghan National Security Forces. They're in the lead in the fight. They've made a tremendous amount of progress, but they still face a number of challenges, and they still need our help. It also bolsters the standing and the government of Ashraf Ghani and Dr. Abdullah Abdullah. This is the first government we've seen come out of a peaceful democratic transition in Afghanistan. It's a government we can work with. It's a government that we want to succeed. And lastly, it also helps shore them up as they explore the possibility of peace negotiations with some elements of the Taliban. So it's a very important decision, and I think a really smart one that the president deserves a lot of credit for.
What about the space between Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah?
You know, on this issue, I think they're very united, and I think they're united on a lot of their agenda. The main challenge they've had is in filling out the various positions in the Afghan federal government and also appointing the various governors and so forth. They've been way too slow in getting those appointments done. I think they probably heard that message a great deal during their visit in Washington from just about everyone, and I think they'll return to Afghanistan hopefully with a renewed commitment to get the government personnel set so we can move forward.
And turning to you, Larry Korb, how do you react to the president's decision? Is it a good idea to delay the drawdown?
Well, I think you can delay the drawdown till after the fighting season's over. But I think what you have to be careful of is if you don't set a date to get out, they're not going to deal with the real key problem in there, which is corruption. Until they get that under control, they're not going to be able to prevail. I mean, you know, I looked at some statistics. Half the people in Afghanistan pay bribes to their teachers. So no wonder they joined the Taliban. And, you know, the Afghan security force is over 300,000. How big are the Taliban? So the idea that, you know, they can't win without us, I think, is really stretching us. Us being there certainly can help them. But I think, you know, General Campbell said something that was very interesting. He said, look, the Taliban doesn't have close air support. Why are you, calling us all of the time? They don't have up-armored Humvees. They don't have howitzers. You know, you should be able to do this by yourself. And I think that's a key thing. If you do not keep a deadline to say, hey, okay, we'll still have people, you know, in the embassy, they're not going to do what they need to do to get the people in the country to support that government. I agree that, Ghani and Abdullah are certainly much better than Karzai was, but they're not there yet. If you read the reports from the Special Inspector General, you know, that we have for Afghanistan, still an awful lot of money, you know, being wasted.
What about that corruption, David?
Well, the corruption is a big problem. The control of out territories is a big problem. The Taliban are in control of some places today that they weren't in control of prior to our arrival. And I think we also have to be very cognizant of the fact that one of the reasons we're in Afghanistan is not Afghanistan, it's Pakistan. It's the terrorist groups that live in the tribal regions there. It's using Afghanistan as an ability to see them, to reach out and to touch them when we need to do that. By pulling back, we limit our ability to do that, and we weaken our whole effort to combat violent extremism. The spread of groups like ISIS or ISIS franchises or, to Afghanistan is being cited by the current leaders as a potential problem. And what I worry about is this government might coalesce. It might gain some capability to govern, but it's not going to be able to do that throughout all of Afghanistan. And so what you'll end up with are pockets of extremism, pockets of unrest, pockets that represent a potential future cancer that could spread. And as we pull out and as our money pulls out, the risks grow.
So, Michelle, is this government able to keep the Taliban and other splinter groups at bay?
I think that's the key question. And I think right now the answer is if they have our continued support, not only in terms of training and advising the security forces, but in terms of the financial assistance. You know, when you look historically at when Afghan governments have fallen, it's been when international assistance has dried up. After the collapse of the Soviet Union and when the Soviet Union stopped providing financial assistance to Afghanistan, that's when the government fell, and we saw the Taliban come in. This government still depends on the continued support of the international community, and that will be true for some time. It won't be as much as they required in the past, but it will go, you know, it will continue. I think that's one of the reasons why President Ghani has put such an emphasis on anti-corruption. He's reopened the investigation of Kabul Bank. He is putting each Afghan ministry through a process of being certified by the international community to be able to receive foreign funds and deal with them accountably. So this is a work in progress, but, you know, it's going to take some time. And so he's going to need continued international support for a number of years.
What about the American people and their feelings about this?
Yeah. You know, I think there is a tremendous war weariness for understandable reasons after more than a decade of war. But I think we have to put this in context. Our commitment has come down by about 90%. This is a very modest commitment to ensure that we sustain the gains that have been made and that we put Afghanistan in the position of securing its own future.
Michelle Flournoy, former Undersecretary of Defense and co-founder and chief executive officer of the Center for New American Security. Short break here, and when we come back, your calls.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. From Emily and Antoine Van Achtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back. We're talking about the president's latest decision on troop levels in Afghanistan, announcing he would halt troop withdrawal and keep nearly 10,000 military personnel in Afghanistan through the end of this year. Here in the studio, Larry Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. David Rothkopf, CEO and editor at the FP Group, which publishes Foreign Policy magazine. He's author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear, and Michelle Flournoy, co-founder and chief executive officer of the Center for American Security, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Obama administration. Here's an email from Jeff. So what does the U.S. get out of this arrangement other than perhaps a little more stability in Afghanistan? Also, how many U.S. troops do we lose a month or a year there? How much does it cost us a month there in dollars? And finally, is it worth it? Michelle.
Well, I think what we gain is continued progress towards the fundamental goal of this operation from all along, and the president said it again and again, which is prevent Afghanistan from once again becoming a safe haven for international terrorists.
Another Iraq.
Yes, or and really, you know, there are still al-Qaeda affiliates in the region, although much degraded. Now we have ISIS showing up to try to recruit elements of disaffected Taliban. So this is a region that is still a hotbed of international terrorism. It's in our interest not only to help create capable Afghan forces that can hold their own territory, but also to continue to conduct joint counterterrorism operations. A small number of our troops are actively continuing to go after high-value targets, al-Qaeda, ISIS, otherwise, that come across the border into Afghanistan. And that's in our interest to keep that pressure up.
And what about cost in dollars and lives?
Well,
Larry Corr.
We've spent over $1 trillion so far in Afghanistan. We've given $100 billion just in military assistance to these Afghan security forces. We've lost about 2,200 young, brave young men and women so far. We've had over 20,000 wounded. And I think the key thing, and you mentioned it earlier, that's been overlooked, it's not just us, it's the region. You're never going to prevail in Afghanistan or have it stable without Pakistan. Pakistan is theoretically our ally, but we've got to lay the law down to them. You've got to stop helping these people, or we're going to, you know, cut off aid. And the other thing is, it's not whatever happens there is not just us. It's a regional problem. Remember, the Iranians worked with us back in 2001 because they didn't like the Taliban either. OK, you got the Chinese, you got the Russian. Nobody wants to see it unstable. So it just doesn't have to be an American, you know, effort. And the other thing is, in terms of, you know, being a threat to the United States, it's not a threat to the United States. We've got a Department of Homeland Security, which if we had on 9/11, we would have been able to, you know, stop them. So the idea that somehow or another, if it becomes unstable, these people are going to cause, you know, problems for us, I think is somewhat overstated. And that's why I think President Obama yesterday, he said, hey, you guys got more forces than they do. You're going to be able to have to do it on your own. And I think that's the key thing. You don't set a deadline. They'll just keep going on and on. And, you know, as long as we're there.
David Rothkopf.
Well, look, I'm a bit skeptical about the long-term gains that we're going to get for that $1 trillion investment in Afghanistan. I think that this is a region that is prone towards instability, and I think it is going. We are not going to be willing to make the investment to ensure that that possibility disappears forever.
Have we made it more unstable?
I don't think we've made Afghanistan more unstable. I think you can make the case with regard to Iraq that we may have destabilized that region. And I think perhaps you could make the case that because of that and because that ISIS emerged out of that and because ISIS now has a presence in Afghanistan, we may have some responsibility there. But, you know, I do think that we have to deal with the situation not in terms of ideals or perfect outcomes, but best outcomes. And I don't think you can achieve a best outcome in Afghanistan without some U.S. presence, without some continued U.S. support, and without some degree of effort to minimize the risk posed by these extremist groups and to recognize the risk posed by extremist groups in Pakistan, and to keep an eye on Pakistan. Remember, when we came into this, when the Obama administration came into it, there was a general, you know, sort of recognition that Afghanistan was the front porch of Pakistan. It was Pakistan, a country with multiple nuclear warheads, a country with real divides within their political elites, that represented a potentially bigger risk. And we thought this was going to be one way to contain that. We've got to keep an eye on that as well. So this is going to be a frustrating outcome. we are going to look back on the investment in Afghanistan and the loss of life and the $1 trillion spent, and I think we're going to be disappointed with the returns. But that doesn't mean we should stop trying.
Michelle.
I think we're at a really interesting point with Pakistan, because in the last year they've experienced horrific attacks against their own civilian population, particularly the attack that we all heard about on the school where, you know, dozens and dozens of children and teachers were slaughtered. And in response to that, they've taken on a more aggressive military campaign to try to clear out militants in some of the areas bordering with Afghanistan. Some of those folks have come across the border, and we've worked with the Afghans to target them inside Afghanistan. But also, the government of Pakistan, for the first time, seems to be trying to play a useful role in bringing the Taliban to the negotiating table. I think the jury's out as to whether this is going to work, but I think it's a particular moment. We're showing solidarity with the government of Afghanistan. We're not abandoning you. We're standing with you. We're still here to help you, supporting you. That providing reassurance is very important if the Afghans are actually going to be sitting down at the negotiating table to try to negotiate some kind of peace deal, which is really the only way that this conflict will ultimately end.
I think, though, we should avoid making the mistake that we often do in the United States of conflating the government with the country. And the people that we sort of see in the government or the people that we deal with don't represent the totality of the government. And surely after Peshawar, there was a move within the government and a move within some parts of Pakistani society to address some of the problems that were there. But there was also a growth among some of the more fundamentalist groups there. There were the church bombings that we saw. There have been bad trends within Pakistan, and it's an unresolved situation. And this is what we have to worry about with Afghanistan. We can have a guy like Ghani come to the U.S., wear a suit, look like a nice guy, look like he wants to deal with the president, say all the right things. That doesn't speak to the situation on the ground everywhere.
And he's going to presumably say all the right things to a joint session of Congress
today. Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, don't forget, he was educated, you know, in the United States. In fact, he and Obama yesterday were talking about their times at Columbia, for example. He used to be with the World Bank. I remember talking to him back in 2004. You know, he will say all the right things. But the key thing is he going to govern in the correct way? Is he going to, yes, he's dealing with the Kabul Bank, and I think he's making some steps there, but is he really going to go far enough to undermine some of the quote-unquote warlords in there who they rely on?
What about that, Michelle Flournoy?
I think he's going to make every effort to do that, but he's got to build the political coalitions to bring along with him, and this is why this filling out the government with these appointments and getting the balance right. Each of those positions is a way of getting people to buy into a coalition to take the country forward. And that's part of the reason it's taking so long to negotiate.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that happens whenever we go into a country these days is that afterwards somebody will say, well, let's do a Marshall Plan for this country. Let's rebuild this country. You know, let's put our money into this country. And we forget that the reason the Marshall Plan worked was Germany was a prosperous economy before this. It had effective government institutions before this. We had achieved a total victory and could dictate the outcomes. And the Soviet threat gave us a motivation to really fix things. If you look at Afghanistan, the government has never been terribly effective. The bureaucracy has never reached terribly well outside of the capital city. There is no history of a prosperous economy in this country. And for us to think that, you know, good talks with the U.S. Congress or writing big checks is going to produce a transformational change in a condition that's existed 1,000 years is a bit naive, I think.
But even if it's not transformation, the question is what's good enough as an outcome? Can you prevent the collapse of this country? Can we help Afghanistan keep muddling through and continue to make progress and not slide back into civil war and chaos?
Do you believe that's possible?
I do believe it's possible. I think it will, you know, require some steadfastness and resolve on our part, but I do think it's possible.
Should the Afghan government sit down with the Taliban and negotiate?
I think that at some point that has to happen, and I think they should do it from as much a position of strength with our support as they can. You will never get peace with the entire Taliban, but what we can hope to see is a splitting of the Taliban between those who will be willing to work with the government, and those who are more radical and who will stay on the battlefield, but in much smaller numbers.
David raised a good point, which is so critical. We went in because the Taliban had given support to bin Laden. Then somehow or another, without thinking about, we transformed into nation building. And, you know, this is incredibly difficult, well beyond ours. Then when we tried it, we got diverted to Iraq and didn't do it correctly. So we're really living with all the mistakes that we've made in addition to what's happened there. And that's why I think there's not going to be a perfect outcome. Yes, they've got to negotiate. The Taliban are going to have some control there. But in the final analysis, it's them. If those people in the security forces are not willing to fight and die for their country, nothing, doesn't matter how long we stay.
Right. Which is what we saw in Iraq, where you had big security forces and they didn't do their job. But, you know, I have to say, I'm extremely skeptical of the notion of the good Taliban. I know that Ghani behind the scenes is saying, we are going to bring some of the Taliban into the government. In the first instance, no matter how good those Taliban are, they're going to be bad for Afghan women. They're going to be bad for a lot of the progress that's been made in that country, and I think that's something that ought to be important to us. Secondly, there will certainly be a large number of Taliban who are not brought in, who remain a potential threat within this environment, who have benefited from chaos. And I think across the Middle East right now, and this is not technically part of the Middle East, but it's in this sort of general region, across this region, what we have seen is that extremist groups seek instability. They seek failing and failed states because that's the petri dish in which they flourish, right? And so all of these groups have a very high incentive to thwart this. And so even if a little progress is going to be made, I'm almost certain you are going to see pockets of resistance and extremism in this country for the remainder of the foreseeable future.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Michelle Flournoy, how worried are you about what's happening in Yemen, and how does it relate to the president's decision regarding Afghanistan?
Well, I think the situation in Yemen is quite concerning. You know, you basically have had first a coup and now a situation that seems like it may be heading towards a full-fledged civil conflict or civil war. Latest reports have President Hadi fleeing the area, if not the country. This is a situation where a Houthi insurgency representing the minority Shia in the country have gained tremendous momentum and taken a lot of territory, including the capital city, now moving south in a country that's majority Sunni. And I think everybody's been shocked by the extent to which they've been able to make progress. This is a conflict which is of great interest to the surrounding powers. You see Iran supporting the Houthis. You see the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia in particular that will be supporting the Hadi government or what remains of it. And this could very quickly degenerate into a more fulsome proxy war.
And what about the treatment of women and the men who lynched Farkhunda? Will they be punished?
One would certainly hope so. But I think, you know, it remains to be seen. It was an absolutely horrific episode that is sort of beyond words. And I think everyone who's been made aware of the incident wants to see the perpetrators brought to justice and held accountable. How that actually happens, I think, remains to be
seen. She is a woman who reportedly tore a page from the Quran. It was determined afterward she had not done anything of the sort. She was stoned and burned and then hanged. And now police themselves have been arrested in that incident. Dear God.
It's repulsive behavior. And I think, you know, we have to look at all of these situations on several levels. And on one level, you know, with that or with blowing up school buses full of children, you can't help but be disgusted. On another level, as Michelle was referring to it, the security situation there has deteriorated in a very worrisome way that has regional implications. There's a 1,000-mile border with Saudi Arabia. It plays into the Shia-Sunni conflict in the region. And by the way, it's happening at the same time that you have the same kind of thing happening in Libya, where you've got a major meltdown underway. Obviously, we have Iraq. We have Syria. We have Sinai, which is a region which is quite unstable and disturbing at the moment. And so you've got the security destabilization, but there is one other element that we need to keep in mind, and that is sort of the regional geopolitics. The Iranians are gaining influence here to the extent the Houthis gain influence here. The Iranians have gained enormous influence in Iraq by being, you know, via the Quds forces at the front of Shia militias, winning the fight against ISIS wherever it's being won, getting credit for that, and gaining influence within Baghdad. The Iranians have their proxy in Syria, Assad, likely to be in power after President Obama has left office, and have maintained a foothold there through Hezbollah in Lebanon, through Hamas in Gaza. They maintain significant influence in this region. And if anybody has gained in the Middle East as a result of the unrest, it's them. As we're on the verge of a nuclear deal with them, which, by the way, I think we should pursue the best nuclear deal we possibly can, so let's stipulate that. If sanctions are lifted and the Iranians gain economic strength as a result of this, this could help them consolidate that even further.
David Rothkopf, Larry Korb, Michelle Flournoy, they're all here to answer your questions after a short break.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring email marketing software, automation tools to send personalized messages, and built-in analytics on desktop and mobile devices. Learn more at myemma.com. From America's Natural Gas, learn how Tote Maritime is working to reduce emissions across their fleet by building container ships that run on natural gas. Learn more at thinkaboutit.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, for this month's Reader's Review, Anthony Doerr's novel, All the Light We Cannot See, the 2014 bestseller, weaves together the stories of a blind French girl and a German orphan during World War II. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to open the phones first to Sarasota, Florida. Hello, August. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. I listen to you faithfully. Thanks. I also do a radio show myself called The Morning Edge in down in Bradenton, Florida, but
good.
Three times a week. And we discuss the issues a lot, especially the false notion that Iran is the culprit. Iran has never started a war, to my knowledge, and they've been attacked by Iraq in the past, the Iran-Iraq War. I know you're familiar with all that. But what we did in 1953 echoed to 1980 and to 2 years ago on the set aside of their government. and the legally elected government. And we apologize through our CIA to them. The Iranian situation is they basically have had democratic processes, and Islam is taught in the most extreme way through Sharia in Mecca, in Saudi Arabia. And we make them our friend because they have the cheapest oil, $10 a barrel. And the cost of oil coming out of Iran is 120 plus. So Saudi does more mischief and all of these countries, including Yemen, and with the propaganda running around saying it's Iran, it's Iran, it's Iran, we get this false set of ideas. And
yeah, I think August makes a couple of good points. I mean, the Saudis, for example, how many lynchings did they have last year? And I'll tell you, when I was in Afghanistan in 2011, Brahimi and Pickering put together a task force to see what we could do. I remember Brahimi did the bond conference. He was responsible after 9/11. But anyway, we met with the former number two in the Taliban, okay, who was a Mullah Omar's. He was arrested. He was in prison. He's now out. And I asked him, I said, if you come back to any part of Afghanistan, how will you treat women? And you know what he said? Don't worry. We won't be any worse than the Saudis. And, you know, I think we have to be so careful about this hypocrisy. I hear people saying, well, you can't work with Iran now in Iraq. We work with the Soviet Union in World War II. So this idea, I mean, you know, nations don't have permanent friends or enemies. They have permanent interests. As long as the Houthis are in Yemen, you're not going to see much of al-Qaeda there because they're Iran. They don't like al-Qaeda, and they don't like ISIS.
Michelle.
I don't think we should have rose-colored glasses on with regard to Iran. Iran is a vigorous supporter of terrorism throughout the region, whether it's Hezbollah in Lebanon and elsewhere, Hamas. They have supported militias in Iraq that consistently and targeted U.S. forces when we were there. I mean, this is a revolutionary regime that is extremely anti-American in its orientation and is very much one of the most active supporters of terrorism and instability in the region. So it doesn't mean that we can't find common ground to constrain their nuclear program or work in other areas, but we shouldn't have any illusions about the nature of this regime.
Right. Who was the first Muslim country to condemn the attacks of 9/11? Iran.
You know, we've fallen into a trap, and I think the listener has fallen into the trap a little bit, too, and that is to say, these are the good guys and these are the bad guys. There are no good guys and bad guys.
That's
these
right.
Countries are not monolithic countries. There are no perfect outcomes here. You know, when you listen to Michelle talk, and Michelle's been one of our best officials in dealing with these areas for a long, long time, you hear the voice of somebody who says, well, I can't get a perfect outcome. What's the best outcome that I can get? How can we make a little progress here? You know, the Iranians are waging a cyber war against us. We shouldn't take our eye off of that, and we should figure out how to deal with it. But if we can make a little ground on the nuclear issue, let's make the ground on the nuclear issue. Let's try to get the best possible outcome. But again, as Michelle says, no rose-colored glasses either way.
All right. To Baltimore, Maryland. Hi there, Eugene. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane. I'm a first-time caller.
Good to have you.
Very much enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I've been listening to the statements and comments that have been made on the show, like the comment about the Marshall Plan and the comment about no good guys and bad guys, and I think those are quite astute and quite to the point. But I think we as Americans are confused. We talk about exit strategies. If you're in a military situation, the exit conditions are for a short-term engagement. You win, you achieve your objective, and you leave. If it's long-term combat, then you are looking for to either A, destroy your enemy, have an armistice, or have a surrender. And then you leave. If you've destroyed them, if you haven't destroyed them, then you have to stay and you have to occupy them, or your other alternative is to salt the ground and then leave. The next thing you do is you remain engaged, and you do the Marshall Plan. I mean, we are still in Germany. We're still in Italy. We're still in England. We're still in Korea. and we're still in Japan. That's what we did. The only other alternatives are you go in and you lose, in which case you are destroyed, or you retreat, or you surrender.
I think that the caller has a really makes an important historical observation, is that, you know, there tends to be a tail end post-conflict. You know, U.S. forces are, except for the very specialized counterterrorism forces, U.S. forces are out of combat in Afghanistan. We are in the advise and assist role now. But the training and preparation of those forces to be viable in their country, to be a partner in the region in the future, is not going to magically be finished on 2016. There's going to be continued work to do. As we've continued to work with our allies in Europe over the last decades, they have become a tremendous asset to us as allies, not only in Europe, but elsewhere in dealing with challenges elsewhere in the world. So there is a tail end to these things. I don't think there's anything that looks like continued occupation, doesn't look like continued large-scale combat. It looks like continued military assistance to help a partner stand up, be in the lead, and succeed, or at least muddle through. And that is a lesson of history. And you can't sort of abandon the process without that final phase if you really want to secure your gains.
There have been two myths, right? There was a myth in the Bush administration that we could go in and transform the region. Didn't happen, isn't going to happen. There has been a myth that has been popular more recently that we can somehow opt out of the region. Okay, can't happen. Because as Larry said, it's all about our national interests. Do we have national interests in the Middle East? We have a whole variety of national interests in the Middle East. And in the long term, whether it's related to energy or related to the stability of the region or related to the potential for foreign fighters for destabilizing our allies or related to the potential for instability in this region to spill over into places like Pakistan or elsewhere in Africa, we have interest in maintaining stability here, and that requires some ongoing engagement and some ongoing commitment beyond what our recent experience gives us much of an appetite for. We have to find the best way forward to do that, to have that debate, and we haven't done it. Meanwhile, and I think this is important because we get sort of caught up on the ground level, the Iranians turn to Russia, turn to China. The Gulf states turn to Russia, turn to China, turn to the Indians. The Israelis, as they become less comfortable with the U.S., turning to China, turning to Russia, turning to the Indians. In Sharm el-Sheikh, Sisi of Egypt had a conference about how he was going to fund rebuilding his government, turning not only to the Gulf, but turning to Russia, turning to Asia, turning to India. Other countries are going to gain influence. Now, some Americans may say, hey, that's great. We've had enough. We don't need any more from this. But that doesn't mean we don't have long-term interests here and that we wouldn't benefit from playing a more constructive role with a longer-term perspective.
Well, I think two things. Nations don't have permanent friends or enemies. They have permanent interests. Where we have to be careful is our rhetoric when we're talking about, oh, we're for democracy and on women's rights and all that kind of stuff. And then people see you're dealing with Saudi Arabia. So I think we got to tone down the rhetoric. And, you know, when you had the Arab Spring came, well, we're for democracy. Well, it didn't turn out too well in Egypt. And now we're getting the worst of all possible worlds. So that's what I think we have to be careful of. You know, in World War II, after we allied ourselves with Stalin, we called him Uncle Joe back here. And that's what you don't want to do. I think we and the Iranians have a lot of interests in common. We ought to work together where we can. Are there areas where you don't, then you don't work with them.
All right, to Tallahassee, Florida. Brian, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I just wanted to make a comment in reference to something that was said earlier. I believe it was Ms. Flournoy that pointed out that the Iranian government has not, one of the things that they haven't managed to do yet is fulfill their certain positions in the government. And I just wanted to say that I don't want to hear any Republican, and certainly not one Republican senator in the United States, make any comment about that after what they've done in this country to keep appointments from being filled. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for your call. Any comments?
We can have a competition for government dysfunction and paralysis.
No. Well, I was thinking of that earlier when somebody said Ghani was American educated, and I thought to myself, well, so are most of our leaders, and that hasn't gotten us very far.
Exactly. Let's go to Alexandria, Virginia. Mohammed, you're on the air. Mohammed.
Yes, Diane, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, sir.
I find that the cognoscenti in this town are totally ignorant of history. All these countries, the borders are literally they're composed by the British Empire. Winston Churchill personally drew the boundaries for Iraq, and you therefore have intense competition and instability in these places. What is happening now is the British Empire is finally retreating, despite American pressure otherwise, and you have the Shia coming out because they're being suppressed by the Sunnis, and you have the collapse of all these other countries at the same time. So what are you going to do? So you say, is there American interest? What is American interest then in that situation of complete disaster, of collapse?
I think the primary American interest is in some kind of stability and in finding partners that we can work with. It is absolutely true that the borders that were drawn with at the end of the British Empire in the Middle East almost predetermined the propensity towards conflict because they divided sectarian groups. They made no sense whatsoever in terms of matching national borders to concentrations of like-minded people or groups that identified as, sharing a common identity. But at this point, the question is, do we want to see the complete dissolution of that order as poorly constructed as it was? Or do we want to try to support more inclusive forms of government in a place like Iraq to say, we want to create ensure that Iraq can survive as a multi-ethnic entity? I think the jury's out on whether that's still possible.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show and to Pat in Concord, New Hampshire. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for getting my call in quickly. I'm a retired combat vet, and I just heard one of your guests say that except for some special operations forces, all of our combat forces, or all of our forces in Afghanistan are out of direct combat. I have several friends who are today in combat operations, not special operations, and I find that very offensive. This is indicative of the disconnect between our civilians, including the people right around your table right now, it sounds like, whose warm pink bodies are being protected by people they don't appreciate. It is in 2 days, or 3 days, the anniversary of the death of a close friend of mine in combat operations over there, that and doing things that people just don't appreciate. And I'd like you to address that.
I do believe, Pat, that we do appreciate not only your service, but the loss of your friend, for which I offer my condolence. I must say, I heard the same thing this morning, that these troops are not all out of harm's way.
Well, and I think that's the key thing. When you say, it gets to this debate about boots on the ground and things like that. When you are in a war zone, you're in danger.
Exactly.
And if you go out to help them in counterterrorism operations, you're going to be in danger.
Have been asked to go out
and help
them. And
so I think that's where we have to, we have to be careful. And that's why I think it's so important for President Obama to put a stop to this. At the end of this time, it's up to you guys. If you can't defend your country after we've given you over...
So you want a deadline of the end of 2015.
End of 2016.
16, you want.
Right. I think just you have what they call a special operations compound or something like that. And it's up to you to do it now. You're 3-4 times bigger than they are. You've got better equipment. And if you don't want to do it, And this gets to something else been raised. You got to do a cost-benefit analysis when you do these things. Yes, we would like to have a stable world. We would like to do this. But what is the cost and what are the benefits?
You're shaking your head, David.
Well, I agree in principle with the things that Larry said, but my sense is that what I'd like to see first, rather than a number, is a strategy. I'd like to see what it is we're trying to achieve in Afghanistan, what it is we're trying to achieve in Pakistan over the long term. I don't think you can make a conclusion about a number until you look at the strategy and see where you stand vis-a-vis that. And my suspicion is going to be, given the threats that are going to continue to exist, that we are probably going to need to maintain some kind of force. And I would be willing to wager that the next president of the United States, regardless of what President Obama leaves us with, will end up with something in the way of more troops there, whether it's 5,000 or 10,000, for precisely that reason.
Michelle.
I just wanted to circle back to Pat's comments because I think what I said was misunderstood. I'm the first person to say how much I appreciate the sacrifice that people have made for the mission in Afghanistan, having been part of the decision-making process, advising Secretary Gates and the president on this issue. I feel personally responsible for some of this. And I, too, have had friends and colleagues who have been injured and killed in Afghanistan. So I completely honor and appreciate the tremendous human sacrifice that has gone on in support of this mission. What I was trying to say is that the primary purpose of U.S. forces now is the advise and assist mission. Of course, many people are still in harm's way, and nobody overlooks that.
Michelle Flournoy, David Rothkopf, Larry Court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts.